In the late 1990s, when Jimin Kim was in the South Korean Air Force, his job was to monitor on a big screen all of North Korea's flights.
And you could see that there were no flights. If you're an Air Force pilot, you need to go on missions to conduct practice flights so that you can be ready to fly. Because North Korea is restricted and have no energy resources, they cannot even provide their military air force to conduct exercises. So it goes on to show how much the North Korean military is, they have a true retaliatory capability or not.
Today on the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour, now Deputy Consulate General from South Korea, Jimin Kim, gives South Korea's perspective on the recent hostile provocations by North Korea. And he talks about the continuing importance of their alliance with the United States. All that's coming up on the program today. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Ross Chambliss. This past week, the Deputy Consulate General from South Korea, Jimin Kim, was at the University of Utah. He spoke about many things, but mainly the growing tensions with North Korea and the important role of South Korea's long-held alliance with the United States. Deputy Consulate General Kim is currently based in the South Korean Consulate in San Francisco. He's been a career diplomat for 20 years, and in recent years he has worked on programs to address North Korean refugees for South Korea. He has a bachelor's degree from Georgetown and a master's degree from Columbia. Here is Deputy Consulate General Jimin Kim.
Well, thank you, everyone. Thank you very much for coming today. I hope you can hear me very well. Can you hear me? Yes, okay. It's a great honor to be here at this great institution, University of Utah, Hinckley Institute, for today's forum. And on the outset, I would like to, first of all, express our heartfelt and sincere condolences to the families and friends of the victims of Las Vegas shooting. Our thoughts and prayers are with the families, bereaved families and friends. So today, I'd like to cover in a period of 1 hour, a lot of topics. And basically, North Korea has been on the news a lot lately, as you know well. But Korea and the United States has this wonderful alliance relationship. And there's more to North Korean issue and on the peninsula than that. So I just wanted to also give you a good introduction to Korea. How many of you here have been to Korea or have knowledge of Korea? Very interesting number of you, so very good. Thanks for coming today. I'm also accompanied by my two good colleagues here, Consul Sang-hun Oh from my consulate in San Francisco, and Jesse Park back there as well. Our consulate is located in San Francisco, and we've opened our consulate in 1949, and we've been there since 1949. It's a very, San Francisco is a very historically significant and important city for the Korean history, which I'm about to show a little bit later. And our jurisdiction covers Utah, the state of Utah, and also Colorado and Wyoming. And we have the jurisdictions of those. And our honorary consul, Robert Mansfield, is here to represent us here in the state of Utah. And we're very, very grateful for that. And I understand that University of Utah has also opened a campus in South Korea, in Korea, in Songdo campus. I don't know if you've had a chance to go there, but I heard it's a very wonderful campus, and we have this deep relations with the state of Utah, so that's very rewarding to know. So without further ado, I'd like to begin our presentation. So in 1882, that is when the United States and South and Korea, that is, first signed a treaty. And the name of the treaty is, as you can see up there, it's very long, Treaty of Peace, Amity, Commerce, and Navigation, which basically is a treaty that opened up the diplomatic relations between the two countries. And if you, on the right, on the right-hand side of the photograph, that's a photograph of the first ever diplomatic envoy that was formed by the Kingdom of Korea. And they were dispatched to the United States, mainland United States, in 1883. and they set foot in the port of San Francisco in 1883. And this was the first ever diplomatic envoy that visited the United States. And so from then on, San Francisco has become a very significant place for us historically. And as you know well, you've heard about the Korean War, which divides Korea to this day. The war is not completed yet. We've only signed an armistice treaty agreement, so there's no peace treaty. And these are some of the photos from the Korean War. And during the Korean War, one of the most, the highlight of the Korean War, that is, the battles, the most heavily fought battle is the Battle of Changjin or Chosun. Chosun is actually the Japanese pronunciation of Changjin. We were colonized by Japan from 1910 to 1945. And this is in the north, what is present-day North Korea. The United States Marines advanced across the northern part of the peril. In 1950, North Korea invaded South Korea across the 30th peril. And in 1951, the war went on, and we moved up all the way to the north. And so this is a significant battle where also the Chinese People's Army first entered the war. And it was a very cold winter. But OK, I'll just point out, on the right side, as you can see, those are the Korean refugees. That's where the during the battle on Hungnam Port, there was the Hungnam Port of evacuation, where 14,000 Korean refugees were able to go on the ship called the SS Meredith Victory, which is a US merchant ship. General Ned Almond of the United States ordered the captain of the SS Meredith Victory, which is a merchant ship, to dump all the weapons and artillery and tanks into the sea to allow the Korean refugees to go on board so that they could be saved. And so this was in December, and we call this a Christmas miracle because the ship sailed from the Hungnam port, which is in North Korea right now, and it sailed through the seas infested by mines and arrived at Gojedo in south near Busan on December 25th. And this was a big humanitarian victory. And in the middle, this photograph is the current president, who was inaugurated in May, current president of Republic of Korea, President Moon Jae-in. And this photograph is when he visited the United States, officially visited the United States, Washington, D.C., at the end of June this year. And he visited, the first place he visited as soon as his plane arrived is the Chosun or Changjin Reservoir Battle Memorial in Virginia, because his parents were on that ship, on the SS Meredith Victory, SS merchant ship. Thank you very much.
Yeah, push that one.
Okay. His parents were on that ship, and probably in that photograph too. And he was born 2 years later at a refugee camp in South Korea. And so his life would not have begun if it wasn't for the United States military's kind humanitarian assistance to save all these refugees to evacuate. And so in 1953, there was the armistice agreement was signed between the Soviet Union, the North Korea, and the United Nations forces. It was signed in 1953, and it's still, the war is not ended at the moment. We're still technically at war. And the United States and Korea signed the 1953 Mutual Defense Treaty to help each other in times of war. So the agreement commits the two nations to provide mutual aid if either faces external armed attack and allows the United States to station military forces in South Korea in consultation with the South Korean government. So right now we have about 29,000 U.S. Forces Korea stationed in the Republic of Korea. So our Korea-U.S. Security Alliance, as you can see, is very strong and tight and robust. We conduct military exercises, joint military exercises, every year in middle of August. And our tight, robust alliance is very important to deter any North Korean provocations. Under this United States and Korea security cooperation, under the umbrella of the U.S. security, South Korea, from a decimated, devastated, war-torn, ravaged country, was able to build a vibrant democracy. And as we call it, the miracle on the Han River, a vibrant economy as well. This is the photograph right after the end of the Korean War. You can see the rummages and devastation. But this is downtown Gwanghwamun near the Gyeongbok Palace, and this is how it is today. So we've reached a robust economic development over a course of a generation in a very short span of time. So this is just to show you the GDP per capita growth of Korea from 1960. It was one of the poorest countries in the world, and rapid development in the 70s and 80s to reach up to almost 30,000 GDP per capita growth today. Partnership for Prosperity. So now, from a military alliance, our alliance has grown to global partnership, a strategic partnership. This is a photograph of the CORUS, Korea-United States Free Trade Agreement negotiations. And currently, right now, today, as of today, the special session on the Korea-U.S. Joint Committee on FTA is being being conducted in Washington, D.C. right now. At the moment, the United States government, the USTR, the U.S. Trade Representative Lighthizer, requested the Republic of Korea for this joint committee to discuss about the free trade agreement. As you know well, President Trump has been on the news a lot mentioning the Korea-U.S. free trade agreement and that he wants to sort of renegotiate it. But a free trade agreement is where you either modify or amend. And at the moment, the United States requested, U.S. government requested for a joint committee to discuss, to review the FTA. And that first session was held in Korea in August. And we're right now conducting the second session in Washington, D.C. at the moment. And this is a very mutually beneficial free trade agreement. As you can see, this was the free trade agreement went into effect in 2012. And the growth, the volume of trade has been growing substantially since then. And also the investments by major Korean companies in the United States has been growing as well through the CORUS FTA's backbone. So this Alliance for Peace and Security, like I've mentioned to you, is not only alliance for military alliance, but it has grown to also a very strategic partnership. Korea also joined the United States in the Vietnam War, Iraq, and Afghanistan. And peacekeeping operations, Korea is committed to the peacekeeping operations around the world. And also our aid program, we were an aid recipient. We're probably one of the few or unique countries who was an aid recipient that became a donor country. Humanitarian assistance, and also environment, global issues, environment and climate change. Korea is also a forerunner and participant in all these multilateral global movement on climate change and to protect the environment. So this is a photograph of our president meeting President Donald Trump at the recent United Nations General Assembly, the second General Assembly. So all of these are very important. What I would like to pinpoint is the robust Korea-U.S. alliance is something that we should cherish. It's something that has been historically going on for a very long time. And this is the robust Korea-U.S. alliance that can keep our peninsula secure, our region secure, and our protect our region and then to promote peace and security. So, but as you know well, that the peace on the Korean Peninsula has been provoked by North Korea or Kim Jong-un regime's recent provocations, which is on the news a lot. And I just wanted to show you this photograph of the Korean Peninsula at night. As you can see, North Korea has very energy-stricken country at the moment, very secluded, especially after the end of the Cold War. The Korean Peninsula is the last vestige of the Cold War. We signed the Armistice Treaty in 1953, so it's about 64 years, but still the Cold War has not ended on this peninsula. And as you can see, the contrast from the North Korea and South Korea from there on. North Korea's hostile provocations is not a recent phenomenon. It has been going on for a very long time. North Korea is as they say in scholarly terms, a pariah or rogue state that has been cornered and secluded. This photograph here is a 1968 provocation by the North Korean espionage commandos. They infiltrated into Korea to assassinate the then president of the Republic of Korea, President Park Chung-hee, and they came very close to the Blue House, which is the presidential palace, presidential office in Seoul, to assassinate their motive. And I think this they're putting something in his tongue so that he won't commit suicide by biting his tongue. So this is a submarine, North Korean submarine on the East Coast that infiltrated as well. And these are recent provocations in 2010. This is the bombing of the Yongpyeong Island on the west coast of Korea near Seoul. Seoul is only about 40 miles from the demilitarized zone. And North Korea, of course, does not claim that they did it. This is the bombing of our corvette, a Korean naval ship, by a North Korean torpedo. They did an analysis on the ship, and it was a multinational research into what had happened, and the conclusion was that it was done by a North Korean torpedo, but obviously the North Koreans are claiming that they didn't have anything to do with it.
And that's Deputy Consulate General Jimin Kim speaking this past week at the University of Utah. Coming up, Consulate General Kim talks about South Korea's perspective on the recent hostile provocations by North Korea. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts of more local shows and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Ross Chambliss. On this program, we record and broadcast the many engaging lectures, debates, and panel discussions held at the Hinckley Institute of Politics, and we replay them as a public service. And today, we are airing a talk given this past week by the Deputy Consulate General from South Korea, Jimin Kim. Kim spoke about the importance and the history of the alliance between South Korea and the United States, and how the South Korean government views the recent hostile provocations by North Korea, and what his country is doing to prepare for a possible conflict.
Nuclear and missile threats is the ongoing threat right now that is coming up on the news a lot. And as you can see, North Korea has developed nuclear weapons, and now they're trying to mount it on an intercontinental ballistic missile or long-range missile to basically threaten the entire world, especially the United States. And this is the photograph of Kim Jong-un, who unusually came up and directly responded to President Trump's speech at the 72nd United Nations General Assembly. I don't know if you heard about him, calling him the rocket man, that he's on a suicidal mission to kill himself. It's very unusual for a North Korean leader to actually come out and directly respond to that. So we had this tit-for-tat war exchange of hostile words going on between the U.S. president and the North Korean leader at the moment, which is also sort of ratcheting up the tension in the region. So this is the North Korea's recent provocations. As you can see from here, Kim Jong-un assumed power in 2012. In 2011, his late father, Kim Jong-il, died of a stroke, heart attack, in 2011 December. And officially, 2012, Kim Jong-un, who was 33 or 30 at that time, very young, or less than 30, he's about 34 this year, he's very young, he's only 34 years old, took power. But as you can see, the contrast, over the 18-year period, Kim Jong-il, his 16 missile launches, as opposed to just over 5 years, 58 missile launches. So Kim Jong-un is making a lot of provocations right now, as you can see. And Kim Jong-un, as you know well, is a little bit paranoid in a sense that he feels that somebody's out there to assassinate him and kill him. Maybe that's one of the reasons why he has been exterminating the factors around him. He has even executed his own uncle-in-law in 2013. So those are some of the things that are brutal. Inhumane occurrences that are going on with the current regime in North Korea. North Korea launched, the recent one is August 29th, a Hwasong-12 intermediate range of ballistic missile. And this intermediate ballistic missile is, this is it all in Korean, I'm sure some of you can read it. These are the regions, and also on September 15th, that's the latest missile, and continuing to prepare the provocations on the North Korea. These are the regions where they have been launching those missiles in 2016 and 2017, continuous provocations. And this here is May 14th. That's when our new current regime was inaugurated. Already more than 10 times there has been provocations conducted by North Korea. The recent launch of these two missiles is significant in the sense that it flew from near Pyongyang across the Japanese archipelago, which alarmed Japan. There were sirens in Japan. This was the first time that two missiles were launched. This was the first time that was launched in a range of about 2,700 kilometers or 1,678 miles. And the second one on September 15th was 3,700 kilometers or 2,300 miles. This is to show that they can hit the U.S. territory of Guam, which is around, if you extended this range down to the south, reaches the range of Guam. So this is a big provocation from North Korea. We have been responding to North Korea's provocation, the United States and South Korea. Immediately following the launching of the missile on August 29th, the South Korean Army military launched our own missiles to show our robust readiness to counter the North Korean attack. And this here is the B-1B Lancer, which is stationed at the Anderson Air Force Base in Guam, which tends to scare Kim Jong-un and his regime. B-1B Lancer is the one that scares him a lot because this is a stealth. Apparently, I don't exactly know the statistics, but it has lots of bombs that it can just release at one time. It's a long-range bomber as well. So this is the recent provocation, after the recent provocation in North Korea, the missile launch. The 22nd, the B-1B Lancers left the Anderson Air Force Base at night at 9 p.m. And around 10:30 p.m., the two squadrons or six planes of F-15 took off from the Kadena Air Base in Okinawa to basically protect flight to protect the B-1B Lancers. And around that time, around midnight, is the time when the B-1B Lancers cross across the northern limit line, across into the North Korea's, not territorial sea, but the close to North Korean territory. And during that time, apparently, North Korea did not know anything about the B-1B Lancer and the U.S. forces conducting this movement up here in this region to demonstrate a force. These are the North Korea's missile defense against any attack. As you can see, SA-5 is the one that can reach the largest range. And this is the B-1B Lancer. When it is conducting its bombing operation, it flies very low up at the 18-kilometer altitude. So this goes on to show that, well, North Korea is provoking. It's making its provocation. But once, does it really have the energy and resources, the military especially, to conduct a warfare? I was in the Korean Air Force, and I was stationed at the Osan U.S. Air Base at a combined intelligence unit with the United States military, Air Force. And my role was to basically monitor the North Korean flights, airplanes, both the civilian as well as jet planes. And at that time, we had this big screen up in our bunker of the entire Korean Peninsula. And this was in the late 90s, early 2000 when I was serving. And you could see that there were no flights. If you're an Air Force pilot, you need to go on missions to conduct practice flights so that you can be ready to fly. Because North Korea is restricted and have no energy resources, they cannot even provide their military Air Force to conduct exercises. So it goes on to show how much the North Korean military is not ready for these type of retaliation, if they have a true retaliatory capability or not. And then, of course, North Korea, in a span of 10 years, it conducted its first nuclear test in 2006, conducted its sixth nuclear test recently on September the 3rd. Despite the international community's concerted demand and warnings, and to our great disappointment, North Korea conducted its sixth nuclear test. The Korean government has made enhanced efforts to convince countries in the region and beyond the necessity for stronger sanctions and pressure to make North Korea stop its provocations and choose the path of dialogue. So following this September 3rd nuclear test conducted by North Korea, the United Nations Security Council convened and unanimously adopted the resolution 2375 on September 11th, 2017. And this resolution reduces about 30% of oil provided to North Korea by cutting off over 55% of refined petroleum products going to North Korea. This was adopted unanimously against North Korea with unprecedented speed and with tougher measures than previous resolutions. It clearly reflects that the international community is collectively outraged and is responding under one voice on the North Korean issue and on the problems occurring on the Korean Peninsula. But despite these North Korea's flagrant violation of its obligations and commitments under the UN Charter, the Korean government and the international community are making every possible effort with great determination to peacefully resolve the North Korean nuclear issue. The United Nations Security Council resolutions against North Korea, which have articulated the principles of peaceful, diplomatic, and political resolution of the North Korean nuclear issue, are also part of these efforts. So this is the span of the North Korea's, the United Nations Security Council resolution. From 2016, it has been, we have been conducting 10 over the span of 11 years resolutions. Now, is the resolution working? Is it making any impact? It is not making an immediate tangible impact, but it is certainly making an impact on North Korea. United Nations resolution is not something that comes out immediately. The impact, the results coming out immediately. It has to be done consistently. It has to be done in a very consistent manner so that it can strain and pressure the North Korean regime to denuclearize, to give up, and to stop its provocations. This chart over here also shows the state of the North Korean economy throughout this period from 2016 to 2016, over the period of 10 years. As you can see over here, are the sanctions really working? 2016, 3.9% growth in the North Korean economy. Well, that is probably because it has been so downturned that it's an upgrade from the top. But I will explain a little bit later in the other slides about the North Korean sanctions and economic state. This is President Trump making his very provocative speech, I guess, over at the United Nations, which also directly, as I explained to you, unusual direct response from Kim Jong-un. He has mentioned that if North Korea continues to conduct these provocative actions, that it's on a that we will have no, and I quote, we will have no choice but to totally destroy North Korea. Rocket Man is on a suicide mission for himself and his regime. The United States is ready, willing, and able, but hopefully this will not be necessary. And he has mentioned hopefully this will not be necessary. Yes, and that's something that our president, who also made a speech, his remarks at the 72nd General Assembly, has stated that we do not, and I quote, we do not desire the collapse of North Korea. We will not seek unification by absorption or artificial means. If North Korea makes a decision, even now, to stand on the right side of history, we are ready to assist North Korea together with the international community. The efforts of the international community should also be further strengthened. So this goes on to show that all nations must thoroughly implement the United Nations Security Council sanctions resolutions and seek measures in case of any further provocations by the North. Unilateral sanctions against North Korea. United Nations Security Council sanctions. Well, the United Nations Security Council, the UN Security Council resolution, how is it enforced? Is it actually being enforced properly? Well, China and Russia voted unanimously to join the UN Security Council resolution, but China is 90% of the trade volume that North Korea now has is with China, and that is why we are trying to pressure China to implement its United Nations Security Council resolution properly. And these are some of the in tandem with the multilateral United Nations Security Council resolution, each country is taking up unilateral actions. And the United States has recently also, the president has issued an executive order on September 21st. This is the fifth time that the United States, since the inauguration of the Trump administration, has conducted this type of unilateral action against North Korea. And this is what we will call similar to the precursor to a secondary boycott. A secondary boycott is where the United States conducts sanctions on any country that does business with North Korea. So sanctions against North Korea, we've talked about how, is it working or not. Basically, after in the mid-1990s, North Korea had a huge famine where millions have died. And since then, the North Korea's communist regime, the communist government, the rationing system has completely collapsed. And because of that collapse, they are basically turning the eye against and allowing these types of changmadang, which are markets where they barter, and it's like a flea market thing, but it's a place where they can barter and trade. These markets are occurring, popping up, and a little bit of economic activities is been overlooked by the government because, simply speaking, there's no way that they can manage and control through a collapsed rationing system. And also China is a big issue factor. Are they actually conducting the sanctions properly? This is the bridge that connects northeast corner of North Korea and China from the city of Dandong to the city of Sinuiju in North Korea. This is the bridge that connects. This is the China side. And these are trucks that are going in there. As you can see, still the economic trade and economic activity between North and South is ongoing at the moment. And China, in 1961, signed a mutual assistance, basically an ally treaty with the North. And they are the sole principal, basically, ally or friend of the North Korea in the region at the moment. But China and North Korea has a very complicated and complex relations at the moment. It's a relation of mutual trust and distrust. It has been like that ever since the Kim Il-sung regime, the Kim Jong-il, the son's regime, and now Kim Jong-un's regime. The North Koreans do not completely trust the Chinese, and neither do the Chinese. So this has been going on historically. That is probably one of the reasons why, maybe perhaps, China does not have a real influence on North Korea. This is the coal. China imports a lot of coal from North Korea. Main source of revenue for North Korea is partially coal export. And the United Nations sanction has put a limit on the amount of coal that can be exported to about 7.5 million tons. And China said it will stop importing North Korean coal. But recently, about 2 weeks ago, China has started to import North Korean coal again, explaining that it still does not go up to the ceiling level, to the maximum level. And the international community is watching closely how it's conducting its implementation of sanctions against North Korea. This is a photograph, a very old photograph of Kim Il-sung and Zhou Enlai, the premier of China. As you can see, historically, China entered the Korean War at the last minute, as I explained to you at the Chosin Reservoir, Changjin Reservoir battle in 1951. And as you can see, it has a very historic ties, but still a very, very complex ties of mistrust and distrust and ongoing trust. It's a very complex tie. And this here is a photograph of one of the key sources of revenue for North Korea. North Korea has over 100 restaurants in all entire China. North Korean restaurants, where it's a big source of foreign currency revenue. And China has recently, under the pressure of the international community, has announced, the Ministry of Commerce of China has announced that within 120 days, so which will be about from next year, January, early part of January, all companies, North Korean companies in China must close down, and also the restaurants as well too. So the Chinese government has announced a very stern and very harsh sanctions against North Korea very recently. China has also been very discontent or dissatisfied with the deployment of the Terminal High Altitude Air Defense System in the Republic of Korea. Basically, this is the United States military installing this THAAD system this year, in the summer of this year in July, at a golf course owned by the conglomerate Lotte Corporation. So as an economic retaliation, there has been some, the Chinese government has been boycotting, and they have conducted a lot of, Lotte has these big Walmart types of, big supermarket types of stores, magazines in China, stores in China. And China, Chinese government conducted tax income surveys and also like to see how the facility is sanitary or not, to give a very harsh time to Lotte. And Lotte has announced very recently that they're going to withdraw all from the Chinese investment. So this is sort of the complex issues going on the peninsula at the moment. And as you know well, this was very controversial. Otto Warmbier, a 22-year-old University of Virginia student, visited North Korea, and apparently North Korea claims that he was trying to steal a propaganda poster, and they detained him. They put him into a 15-year harsh labor, and he came back in a coma, and unfortunately he died a few days later. And these are the Warmbier's parents who came out recently for the first time on media saying that North Korea should be again it's a terrorist country. It's a state. It's a state sponsor of terrorists, and it should be put back on the list of state sponsored of terrorists.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour here on KCPW. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts of more local shows and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org.
This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Ross Chambliss. Today on the program, we're airing a talk by the Deputy Consulate General from South Korea, Jimin Kim. Consulate General Kim is currently based in the South Korean Consulate in San Francisco. He has been a career diplomat for 20 years, and he was at the University of Utah last week, and he spoke about the importance of the trilateral cooperations between South Korea, Japan, and the United States.
Through all these ongoings on the peninsula, the complicated ongoings on the peninsula, the trilateral, the Korea, U.S., Japan, trilateral cooperation is extremely important to maintain the peace and security on the Korean peninsula. But at the moment, these are the new leaders, and this is the Prime Minister of Japan. Korea and Japan has a very complex and tangled history. Korea and Japan is separated by only a very narrow strip of water, but it has a very complex and tangled history where it has been more, there has been more conflict than been friendly ties, and that's mainly because of the history issue as well. Japan does not seem to be going forward with the history issue, and some of the issues that we have, the current issue that I wanted to briefly introduce to you is the issue of the Tokto, which is the islets, two rock islets located in the eastern part of the East Sea of Korea, as well as the naming of the sea. And to explain to you the issue briefly, I think it's more appropriate to show you this video of the position, a short video. So I'd like to turn on the video at the moment.
At this point in his talk, Consulate General Jimin Kim played for the audience two films explaining Korea's position on the Dokto Island, which is in the sea between Japan and South Korea, for which it claims possession. And the other video explains South Korea's argument that the body of water separating Japan and South Korea should be recognized internationally as the East Sea rather than the Sea of Japan. We have links to both of these films produced by the Ministry of Foreign Affairs for South Korea, which you can find online on our website. And here is the remainder of Consulate General Jimin Kim's talk.
So those are some of the current issues, and I've compacted a lot of things here today, from North Korea to this current issue right now. And as you were walking in, you might have noticed that we were showing this the slide of Pyeongchang, where the Pyeongchang Winter Olympic Games is going to be held, the Winter Olympic Games next year in 2018 on February 9th, which is about 127 days from today, will be held in Korea at the in Pyeongchang. And I hope that you will, I understand that in 2002, we had the Salt Lake City Winter Olympic Games, and Utah is a state that is very well known for winter sports. I hope that this Winter Olympic Games will not be affected by the situation in the Korean Peninsula. It is ongoing very well, the preparations, and it will become a very successful Olympic Games. And I wish for you to have a very keen interest in the Olympic Games, the upcoming Olympic Games. So to sum it up, basically, regarding the issues on the Korean Peninsula, I would like to just pinpoint and emphasize the fact that we need to continue the sanctions and pressure against North Korea. The effects of sanctions do not come out immediately. It requires a patience and step-by-step approach. And sanctions are implemented according to domestic laws of each member. So how well it is enforced is very important. And how well it is enforced is very important, not only important, but it's also very important to verify that it has been enforced properly. And continuous sanctions and pressures does affect also psyche and the mindset of North Korea, because North Korea will have to start thinking about what to do in order for its policies as well. So it gives them some kind of impact. So we need to continue that. And these sanctions and pressures are diplomatic tools that are aimed at bringing North Korea back to the negotiating table. And this is what our government would like to have, the North Korea back to the negotiating table to discuss denuclearization. We are not trying to bring down a North Korean regime. That is a message that we want to send out to the world, to North Korea and to the region. And on top of that, this slide shows our president visiting the USFK and our US. What's most important is peace. In order to have peace, we must have a very robust and stout deterrence capability, and that is to have a strong defense capability. And to do that, we will need to have a very strong and robust Republic Korea and United States alliance. And in Korea, when we say the United States with the U.S. alliance, we like to say, let's go together, which is 같이 갑시다 in Korean. So today I've informed you a lot of information, I think. I've tried to put in a lot of things in just a very small session. I hope that it was very informative to you, and I hope that it also brought a lot of interest in Korea to you as well. And I hope that you can spread and share these viewpoints and opinions and information with your fellow students and colleagues. Korea is located, as you know well, between two strong countries, Japan and China. And historically, it has been invaded 931 times. That is only recorded history. And so it's a peninsula that has been a very strategic region, geopolitically speaking, historically. And that's why it has become a very lot of issues in the world stage. And as you know well, East and West Germany was divided into East and West after World War II. But in the Pacific, it was Japan who lost the war. And there was a debate about whether to divide Japan as well between the Soviet side and the U.S. side. But unfortunately, the victim became the Korean Peninsula. And to this day, we are still a divided country. Regardless of the North Korean provocations, South Korea, Republic of Korea, that is conducting it's continuously progressing in its development, and it's continuously becoming a global partner in global issues. So we would always like your support in Republic of Korea, and also we would like you to be also supporters of the Korea-U.S. alliance. And lastly speaking, I understand that as a student, when I was a student, I was very hungry as well, too. So there are a lot of food left here. So if you can just, take it back and share it with your friends and colleagues, and that'll be great, too, as well. Thank you very much for your attention today. Appreciate it. Thank you. Sure.
Hello, my name is Tanya Inyart. I'm a student here at the U. I studied abroad last year in Korea, and I took a class about North Korea. And we were taught that since Kim Jong-un came into power, there's actually been a decrease in refugees coming out of North Korea. But also recently, there's been an increase in refugees choosing to settle in the U.S., including here in Salt Lake City. So as wondering if you have any thoughts about why this might be and what the Salt Lake City community can do to sort of welcome refugees, particularly from North Korea.
Thank you for your question, Tanya. Yes, actually, I was in charge of the North Korean refugees issue when I was back at the headquarters about 4 years ago. Kim Jong-un, let's start back from the history. Kim Jong-un's father, Kim Jong-il, his policy toward the North Korean refugees was that basically if you want to leave, go ahead and leave. Because the majority of, there are right now over 30,000 throughout the history from 1987 onwards, 30,000 North Korean refugees or defectors, that is, have settled in South Korea, a total number. And out of the 30,000, 84% of them are female, and 90% or 80%, basically, majority of them are from the border regions with China, Hamgyeongdo, Hwanghaedo, those regions, and not from Pyongyang. Why does that occur? The phenomenon occurs because it's easy to cross the border from the north, and the central government does have tight control, but it has a tight control over its regime, its cronies, that so to speak. It's close by the Pyongyang government, but the control out on the outskirts regions, it's very doubtful what goes on in there. And so, a lot of the males, for example, are called into the factories and workplaces, and they're checked on a roll call. But the females that you saw in the previous slide have more freedom or leeway to move around, and they go out to the markets to sell products for survival, menial survival, and therefore they cross the border. And some of them are human trafficked as well into northeast China. And those are the majority of people, folks who come down, all the way down to Southeast Asia, and they come to South Korea. And in South Korea, to resettle them in a capitalistic democratic society, we do have a program implemented by the Ministry of Unification. And it's not the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. The Ministry of Unification has a program. It's basically a five-year program to resettle them. And what we do is that we give them about 3 months of time for them to go through this HANA 1, an institute where they go through and they learn skills. They learn about the new society, the democratic capitalist society, because they live through a communist rationing system. So they don't understand the meaning of having to work to earn your living. And so it's very difficult for them to adjust to the new life, new culture. So they have a cultural shock. And yes, it has become an issue because most of them are having very difficulties trying to adjust to the Korean life, South Korean, the lifestyle in the South. And we also provide them with housing too as well. So we provide all these housings and all these help, all these community centers and around the region to help them adjust to the life in Korea. And the majority of them do well. And there are a lot of success stories as well too. Some of them become very successful entrepreneurs opening up Korean naengmyeon, North Korean style cuisine restaurants. And some of them become even celebrities on the show programs and whatnot. But a lot of them also have difficult times. Some of them have a lot of difficult times trying to adjust as well because of the fact that I have just explained to you that you know they have difficulty trying to adjust to this type of lifestyle. And they choose to leave South Korea, but they choose to leave South Korea in a very illegal manner, so to speak. And a lot of them are trying to move to other places. And I believe that in the United States right now, there are about 706 who have settled here in the United States, but the majority of them go to the United Kingdom. In thinking that perhaps if they leave the Republic of Korea, they will have a much better life. But it also depends on case by case. But of course, supporting them to adjust and have to resettle in the new society is something that we wholeheartedly support. And we hope that everybody can also join in helping them to readjust to the settlement in the country. And I hope that sort of explains your question in a sense. But we are working very hard on it. Our government is doing its best to do that by providing all these programs and whatnot. But there are a limitation if you have been grown up in a completely different communist system government. It's not very easy to adjust, and you're right. And also they feel, because they defect, when they defect, they come by on their own normally. They have like homesickness. They also yearn for their families back home. They're worried about their families who might have been, turned into, who might have been put into a concentration camp for having a relative or family who defected to the South.
Please join me in thanking our guests for today's forum.
Thank you.
Jimin Kim is the Deputy Consulate General from South Korea, based in San Francisco, and he spoke at the University of Utah this past week. You can find a link to Jimin Kim's talk on our website, kcpw.org, or in the podcast for this show. Coming up next week, we'll be airing a forum titled Queer Futures. The forum will explore recent and current instances of activism by local youth here in Utah. Questions such as, what are some of the activist strategies that youth are engaging with here in Utah in the LGBT community? And what is the outlook for Utah's LGBTQ community? And what kind of activism do they think this will require? This discussion includes students who are currently in K through 12 grades, and it will be moderated by Jimmy Lee, who's the Youth Program Manager at the Utah Pride Center. This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Ross Chambliss. Thanks for listening.